Corinthians, chapter 7. We're on question number 21. We only got a couple questions to do in there before we move into the next section, which the next section is still in chapter 7, but it begins at verse 14 and takes us through chapter 8, verse 25. And just as a reminder again, and I think there may be some copy still left on the back, that you'll need the questions and the outline for chapter 8, verse 26 through 39, because I missed that altogether. So therefore, those are back there, which, depending on how it works, it may be that we will finish with chapter 8 for the quarter. We'll see. You'll have chapters 9 through 11, and we'll look at when we would come back and look at those in the future if we don't get them completed before the quarter ends, or before the quarter ends. All right, so we're ready to go. Let's see. Brother Elliot, would you lead us in prayer before we begin class?
We ask thee now, Father, to be with those who are sick and unable to be with us, that health may be restored, that we do with us. We ask thee now, Father, to go us through the further portions of the study, and forgive us of our sins. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen. All right. So, again, question number 21. That'll take us to verses 7 through 11, is the outline. And so what did law? And I noticed that, you'll notice in the question that I have law, lowercase, and slash the law, uppercase, do for us. And the reason I did that, it's very simple. Number one, you can't say for certain that he is strictly talking of the law of Moses. Number two, and probably just as important, is whatever we discover that the law is capable of doing or not, all other law would have the same rules apply. So therefore, it's really a moot point. All right? So if God gave, for instance, the non-Jews a law, it has the same standard for design and for application that the law of Moses did, even if there were differences. The same is true because we can prove that through the patriarch age. God would either verbally give commands and instructions through himself directly or through angels, and he would expect them to keep those. And the same standard would apply for application in those instances as it also would for the law of Moses. So, what did the law do for us? I'm sorry, Steph, what'd you say?
I said it revealed sin to us and caused us to, or people to choose to obey or not.
Right, thank you. Yeah, I heard it. Good. Yep. Yeah. Okay. And you know, and Joe, like when you bring that up, it's good to note that, but sometimes, like in Romans, the irony is that the study in Romans is about the schoolmaster is not applicable. But I understand what you're saying. What Paul is saying to the Galatians, okay, that's a good question. I'm going to ask it. Is the law our schoolmaster? Our teacher? Is that what Paul's saying in Galatians 3? That's all right. Go ahead. Who is it for? Who was schooled in it? Jews. So what we learn by principle there is this, that we can learn that God can teach us, and he can teach us. Well, for instance, the law of Moses, in one sense, is our teacher, because Romans chapter 15, 4 says so. Those things that you learned before were for your learning. So, yes, Joe, in that sense, it is a teacher, because that's what a schoolmaster is. Actually, technically, in that context, this is interesting. The pr- person under consideration, when he says schoolmaster, the Jews would have understood them as being the slave who was the attendant of the son that was under the master. He actually was responsible for the child's rearing or education. And he actually would, in some senses, maybe responsible for teaching. So they understood the context. And so in some senses, it is true. Although, when Paul does his arguments for law, his objective is those primary themes. Grace, in other words, you're saved by grace through faith, that you understand what righteousness means and justification. All right? So what we know in this context is when we learn what law can do, we also can learn what law cannot do. And so the object lesson here is law can, I think as Steph pointed out, and David, I think too, transgression and reveal what to do and reveal that you're wrong. Actually, the revelation is you know what to do and you didn't do it is the ideal. Where when Paul argues to the Galatians about what the law was for, while they were trying to say, hey, the law is everything and we're going to make everyone circumcised, you know, all Gentiles included, he says, no, all that was that you learned was to teach you to get to Christ. It was to bring you to. It was to mold and shape you to that point. What Paul says in Romans, here's what laws can do for you. It can show you were a sinner. In other words, it can prove your guilt based upon the evidence. It shows you that you took opportunity to violate the commands of God. It showed you that you decided that you would do that. And then it also demonstrated you knew you were dead at that point because no reasonable person thought the law would save them. I say that tongue in cheek because as they developed their understanding of Moses and Abraham, there was a point in which they were getting at least some to the ideal. In some way, they had a certain security, a blanket as it were, that protected them because they were Abraham's children. And therefore, they, in a strange way, thought on one hand, they were already God's people. But on the other hand, they thought, well, yeah, I have to do some things, whatever that may be, different or better or what have you. And so they understood some concepts, but they had perverted the righteousness of God and the demand of the law, the forgiveness and all of that. But the point was, is any reasonable person would know, hey, I'm a dead man because I have violated law. And the law meant to tell me whether or not I obeyed it or not. That was its job. On the other hand, it also showed you that you needed something else. You had to be looking for something else. But you know what? God explained that. He did that. For instance, in Deuteronomy chapter 18 and 15, we all know what the text says. If you start verse 15 and you follow down through there, paraphrasing what Moses says, he says, God's going to raise up a prophet like me, and you'll have to hear him. No surprise there, because John, for instance, the baptizer, will say, he's the one. I'm not worthy to loose his straps or to tie his shoes, so to speak. He is the one that you need to hear. Well, the Father said that same thing in some remote settings. For instance, the baptism, he said, this is my beloved Son. And he added in Matthew 17 to that select group, James, John, Peter, and Jesus, of course, was there, hear him. And all of that is connective. And not only that, you will understand as you move along that you will learn that the law, it showed them the elements that were necessary, the purity, the holiness, but all of that cannot be had under the law. All it could do was look forward to what would be, all right? So it prepared them for the newness of the Spirit. David.
Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's full grown, brings forth death.
Right. As James reminds, even presumably a Jewish audience, of that very point, to make them aware, hey, sin's your issue. All right, temptation is the starting point, right? But eventually it'll end up in death. Brother Prince.
In the early days of the church, before the New Covenant was written, the church was mostly Jewish and like that, they were able to preach the gospel from the Old Covenant scripture, right?
That's true.
Were they still able to do the same thing with the Gentiles as they went into Gentile areas after the church went, after the gospel went to the Gentiles?
I believe they were. Okay? And the point is, for instance, I'll use this as an example, though you don't know all the audience, but the Bereans in Acts 17 and verse 11. Are we going to just presume the Bereans were all Jews? They might have been, but you don't know that. In which case, you understand that they could have discovered or learned going into a synagogue what Paul had said, whether it was so or not, right? And incidentally, a Gentile could go into a synagogue. It was accessible, right? I'm not saying that they could have grabbed a hold of the law. There's a tendency to take care of that. But they certainly could have learned of God from that. And by permission, be granted access to the scriptures. Now, the more to the point would be, well, if I said earlier that the Jews could learn what they needed to know about the Messiah through the law, and especially as Joe was saying earlier, or Galatians says, it was a schoolmaster for them, what would it be for the Gentiles? Well, in some ways, I suppose it could be like that, but the key is it could do the Romans 15 thing. It could teach them about the hope. It could teach them about the Messiah because it prophesied that from beginning to end, and they could see the connection. It would take, no doubt, more time for some to understand all of those particulars if they were not already proselytes or spending time in synagogue. It would be a lot like when we were in our formative years and we're just learning some things that we're going to have to catch up with. Maybe we haven't studied the law much and we got to learn how that is connected. I can remember when I was young, I said, I know them old books, that Old Testament has something to do with the new, but I'm not quite sure how all that comes together. And that's why it's good to study those things and have a good picture of that. So law can do that, and it should. And it's easy for us to look back and think, well, yeah, it can because we know it because we maybe as adults and mature persons, we've done that, and we've done at least a general study to understand how this fits with that. So yes. And so we don't want to negate the law, not trying to scrap it for a Gentile. Sometimes people do that. But there are times when the New Testament writers particularly emphasize what the law could do for a Jew to get them closer in devotion to Christ because they had a head start. They had been practitioners and they understood all the nuances and all the things that went with it. It would be a quicker study. That would be the only real distinction between a pure Gentile and a Jew. Any other questions? Good thoughts. Did the law become a cause of death for them? Or for me? Or for them, I guess. However, it would up it for me. What does it say in verse 12? Right. God forbid. Maybe your text says something like that. Or certainly not. Or may it not be so. Then the law is holy, as you pointed out. The commandment is holy. Therefore did that which is good become a cause of death for me? May it never be. That's in verse 13. Yours may say, God forbid, or certainly not. Something like that. That's the emphasis. So you're right. It's holy. Okay? Well, that's the point. Which it reemphasizes the argument made that it destroys any construction of the law's, inadequacy. We would say it's inadequate in one way, but it certainly was a good and perfect law in every other way. That is, it pointed out that I was a sinner. It pointed out my sin. And it showed, really, that's the argument Paul was making. It showed the utter sinfulness, or the greatest of the terribleness, if you will, of sin. You know, what it does for us, and it should, and that's what it was meant for in that case, is not to, is to keep us from thinking too little of our sin. You know, we brush things under the rug all the time. If we're not careful, we can say, well, that was bad, but it wasn't as bad as this, whatever that may be. And so we start measuring and tiering our things that we have done wrong, and we get our categories together. And if we're not careful, we're going to make as many insignificant categories as we can and make very few that are important. But law, its job was to say, hey, you adulterer, you're bad. But don't think you're better than a murderer. Or wait a minute, you liar. Or you're the one that doesn't go to the holy days, the festivals as you should. Don't think you get a pass either. You're responsible just as much. You're not any better off than the adulterer or the murderer.
No greater sin. Sin is sin.
Right. Right. Exactly. But see, there's always that temptation. You know, we can say that because that's a fact, and we all can understand that. But does that mean that we all will practice that, you see?
We have always said, well, at least I didn't sin as bad as he did.
Yeah, right. So that's how Paul ends that section, to let you know. Listen, therefore, did that which is good become, that's verse 13, become a cause of death for me? No, may it never be. It was sin's fault, as it were. Now, remember what I said earlier in some of the other sections or the other parts that we've been looking at. Remember the ideal of personification. Paul will also put him in the place in some of these stories as well to help us to understand, and we're going to see that next. But sin is personified. It's not literally sin by itself. It's we doing it, and we become the sinners, but that's the point. But he says, I need to contrast law and sin. Well, here's the deal. Law is perfectly good, but it was sin. But sin, in order that it might be shown to be sin, by effecting my death through that which is good, so that through the commandment sin would become utterly sinful. And there's another reason for that. I mean, obviously, I think it really follows that it's natural. It would be a natural outgrowth if everything goes well. But there's something behind that that should help us appreciate why that's so. What, in the case of this, law saying, here's what sin is, and sin being the one which exposed the utter terribleness of sin, what will it and what can it do for me?
Keep it from doing it again.
Maybe. But the argument of that wouldn't really help, because here's the deal. Have I solved anything if I don't do it again?
Well, you have to have forgiveness.
Well, we're just simply arguing what law and sin, because that's all Paul's doing. He's not talking about external or other things. He's talking about law and sin. So I sinned and say I don't do it again. What is it going to solve? Absolutely nothing. It's done. I'm cooked. It doesn't matter. If I could get by with one sin in my whole life, it is done. I'm cooked. It's already over. I'm dead. That's the point. That's the argument Paul's making. I am dead. There's nothing I can do. All right. So since that is the case, what can it do for me? Right. It can cause me to look to God to desire something. Because I can't solve anything, can I? You know, if it were that simple to where, all right, I did that, I won't do that again. You know, we might reason, it's kind of like what Joe and we were talking about a while ago, I might categorize my sins, but you know another thing I can do? I can just say, well, I won't do that again, and just go on my merry way. And if I actually didn't do that whatever, then I've satisfied myself. But it won't work, will it? Because the point is that once I have sinned, I'm done. I am dead. Now what? Ah, that's the point of this utter hopelessness that he's wanting us to see. That he says it's a natural, it should be a natural outgrowth that you will have utter hopelessness. And what does utter hopelessness cause you to do? When I say there's utter hopelessness, what am I saying? Right, that's right, Jerry. I have no solution, do I? I mean, if there was at least some hope, I could do something. You know, it's kind of like you get yourself in a jam, and there may not be a lot of solutions, but if you think about it long enough, there might be something to get, you know, see, there's some hope, right? It may not work out, but it might. If I go this way, you know, you break down, the car's not running right. I've had some of those moments. And so if I do this, just maybe, right? At least there's some hope. But when you get to the point when it's not possible at all, it's utter. That's the point. Since it's completely hopeless, you are left to say, and obviously in this case, okay, God. Yeah. Then by doing that, now you're looking for his solution. And then you'll be on the right path. That's the argument. Law showed what was good. Sin did its dirty work when we violated, obviously, law. And showed us for who we were. Now, an honest person says, I am hopeless. When you see that picture, always remember those beautiful gospel accounts. We need to probably study some of those sometime. Sermons or a class or whatever. Think of the tax collector in the temple in Luke 18. A man that is just hopelessly, utterly. Think about the tearful woman that I think has already been forgiven. But she's going in, you know, and this Pharisee said, well, doesn't he know who's touching her? But she's just like beside herself because she got the only solution she could ever imagine, right? She's looking for something that Pharisee's not looking for. Right? Think about that. You think about the masses that would come to Jesus, at least among the common peoples. All right? And then take them in contrast to his countrymen, his hometown people in the synagogue when they took him in Luke 4 was getting ready to throw him off the side of the mountain. Or the Pharisees that chased him around and tested him. And so there's the opposite. These are the people devoid of all understanding of their need for God. They can't even see sin. They would be the same ones that would tell you they get it. They know what sin is. They understand the law in that regard. But they don't, because what they are not seeing is the utter hopelessness of sin. That's the key. That's the key element. All right? Any questions about that? All right, the next section, chapter 7, verses 14, that takes us all the way through chapter 8, verses 25. And this is also equally as challenging as the other parts, but we've already set some standards here or precedents as far as what we're looking at. So hopefully it'll help us. Why do I do the things I hate? Now, I'm saying that because Paul says that plainly, doesn't he? Remember what we said about personification earlier about sin? Sins personify. Paul is now putting himself in this place. In other words, he needs someone to illustrate, correct? He's not going to go pick some nondescript person. He's not even going to give us Barnabas or Timothy or anything. He's taking himself. But here's where our traditional Calvinist friends get off base. They presume that what Paul is saying is just that he is just utterly, hopelessly violating God's will. But thanks be to God, while he's in the midst of all this sin, that God's grace is applied. In other words, he can't help himself. You know, I do what I wouldn't do, which, by the way, incidentally, the fact that he wouldn't want to do that is proof that you can't be utterly, hopelessly an evil person, because you at least can think to do good, even if you don't do it. But that's another story altogether. But think about it. So here's the deal. He's putting himself in this case in that position. It's not that Paul is specifically just saying this of himself. He's utilizing himself to show us all who we are. So he's using, as we say, present tense. I and now. Not future, not past, not what I was. So why do I do the things that I hate, he says? Why does he do that? Okay, that's right. Carnal, sold unto sin. So we already got the foundation. We know what it is. The law demands certain things of us. And he's almost overwhelmingly, or too much, he says. It says, I was sold under sin. He's using present tense, but it doesn't mean literally that he's in the midst of all this terrible sin. That's not the argument. So his objective is to contrast the fact that the law is good, as we've already seen, but sin, and he in particular, because he has practiced that, is wholly evil, and he cannot save himself. In other words, what he's saying is, I'm confessing my human inadequacy. That's kind of what I already said a while ago, didn't I? So you see how one point really leads to another? It's not an absolute different section, but it is a transition in one way, because we're getting into some more things developmental. But think about it that way. All Paul is saying, I'm going to show it from my perspective, human, you and I are inadequate to do anything to solve our problem. That's the argument. He's saying that I do the things that I hate, which says plainly that we all have the possibility and the potential for as much good as we do for much evil. See, it's not turned upon its head. Most people are going to argue, you can't do absolutely anything. I say, yeah, most people in the Christian dialogue or faith, you're hopelessly evil and you couldn't do good. Well, then why would Paul even say, I do what I hate? Not everybody hates their sin, by the way. That's not even his argument either. But he is talking about those who are conscious of that, like he would be, and say, I hate that. I know I did it. And when he says he hates it, he doesn't mean that there's nothing he didn't do pleasurable at the time that he enjoyed, but then he comes later and you see the point is he hates it. That could be one element. Or it could be something that you weren't, it wasn't pleasurable, but you got yourself caught up in something, and man, you hate that you did that. Point is that he has recognition of that. All right? Think about it. Romans 5, 14. Romans chapter 5 and verse 14. Keep that in mind when we go through this section. Hannah, read Romans chapter 5, verse 14. All right, so death reigned, it's a statement of fact. Death reigned from Adam even to Moses, even those who did not offend God in the likeness of Adam. All right, that's a fact. Now Paul is saying, though that is a fact, it doesn't mean I don't hate it. So I am confessing I'm inadequate, okay, to solve any problems. That's the key. Now, maybe, again, Calvinist friends at least have that part right, that they understand humans can't solve the problem. At least that's true. I agree. All right? What do I agree with when I do what I hate? That's what Paul says to us next. What do I agree? The law is good. Law is good. Wow, just prove the law was good, which again further emphasizes his point. Explain how sin in my flesh is doing the evil, and it is not me. Remember what we said. It's the ideal of what? Personification. It's not literally. You know, it's like I couldn't help myself because sin's over there doing it, and it's just mindlessly taking me and doing this or that or the other. That's not what Paul's saying. That would be a foolish argument. At least you got to make sense of this and you understand that personification has to be the object. So he's describing sin as the great tyrant seeking to destroy me. It's abiding in me. It's like it's ruling independently. All right? That's what Paul is saying. If it were a person, this is what it would be doing to me. Right? He wants us to see the object of sin. He's not trying to deflect from his guilt. He's just wanting us to see it in contrast to law. That's the important point through this whole section, is in order for us to understand well what is being taught, we got to compare and contrast, and we got to understand what is being contrasted. So this is, again, unfortunate too, because this is where original sin evolves, or had, at least with men like Luther and Calvin and so on and so forth, and has grown, that everything is taken here in such a way that they didn't even stop to think about personification. I don't know why. The ideal's been around, but they automatically honed in. See, Paul's simply just saying, you know, according to them, that he can't help himself. He's a hopeless sinner and as always will be. And I know partly why they go there, right? Because what's the observable fact? Romans chapter 3, verse 23. Okay, that's the observable fact. I get it. You see, if you're doing an analysis, you get that, don't you? If you don't observe anybody not, then your presumption is, okay, we're all sinners. You see where they arrive at it, at least honestly. So when I've already said before that there's great indicators to show that we're not hopeless that away, you do at least get how they might come up with that, right? Because you know what you've done. You've observed other people doing it, and you ain't found one that hasn't. Therefore, makes sense, doesn't it? So Paul ain't personifying. He's just literally saying, this is the cold, hard facts. Though I would rather do better, I do nothing but bad. I'm an evil guy. I'm a sinner, and therefore it's originally built or in me, innate. The ideal of nature, remember, by definition, is not just it has more than one definition as a point. You may define nature as innate. That's a possibility. Innate, simple. What would be an innate quality? Pick anything. Illustrate anything. I'm a male. I'm not a female. Right? That's innate. I'm a human. I'm not a dog. That's innate. I will never change that. That's nature. That's the way we talk about innate nature, where it's something already, a quality that you have. A dog cannot be a cat, and a cat cannot be a dog. It's innate. It's their nature. And furthermore, you could step it down and say, well, this is what a dog does, this is what a cat does, and you know, you observe, and by nature, this animal does this, et cetera, right? The stars have a nature. The sun, the moon has a nature. They don't do the other's jobs, as it were. They do exactly what they're supposed to. By nature, the sun is the sun, and the moon is the moon, and the stars, and so on and so forth. That's one way. That is exactly how the Calvinists will define nature. Every time you get into Romans, they're automatically presuming that it means it is born in ye. It is innate. But what's another way of using nature? A character quality, a decision. You know, certain people by nature are talented musicians. Does that mean they were born with a fiddle in their hand? If we're talking about that. No. But they learned, they practiced. Yes, they may have some abilities that beyond their practice that they're more adept at that than others. I get that. But we're still talking about characteristic. They have to practice that to do that. Concert pianist, right? By nature, that means by characteristic or quality. By quality or nature, I'm a preacher. I wasn't born one. It wasn't a part, it's an automatic. And therefore, it is in my nature to teach, I would say. It's in my nature to preach. Why? Because it's a characteristic I have formulated and practiced. All right? That's exactly how Paul is using this here. You have one of two options when you define nature. And why would you automatically presume that one takes precedence over the other? And everyone who claims that Paul was an absolute helpless sinner by nature because it's born in him is already presuming the one definition over the other automatically. There's no regard or thought for the other option. By nature is a characteristic or quality that I have to develop, that I have to decide to practice. I decide to do, you see. A person that is evil, I mean heinously, and that's the other thing. The fact that if sin were born in us, so the fact that you would see degrees of that is proof that it can't be born in you. Notice who said, oh, it isn't. It's just kind of a, you know, you got that much in you, and you can just go and... But then they would be using nature in the other sense that I just used. It's like all of us are born sinner, but how much will you use of it? That becomes your other nature, the characteristic or the quality that you will develop. So some people are serial killers or serial adulterers or whatever, and others just dabble in these things. It don't work that way. The fact that you have degrees of sin shows that it makes more sense logically to talk about quality or nature in the sense of I have a characteristic, I have a propensity because I have an interest. Some people are thieves and they do enjoy that and they do maybe very well at it. And so therefore, that's their nature. They weren't born out of the womb a thief. Yes.
Some people are homosexual by nature.
Yes. But the second nature, that's what they are. Yeah, homosexuality, that'd be the other thing. You're talking about transgenderism, homosexuality. You get it. If it's what Paul is talking about, which we just said, the second definition, a characteristic, then it makes sense. Otherwise, it doesn't.
That's why we say it's second.
Yes. Right. That's why we use the term second nature, as she points out. You ever think out here? That's second nature to him. What we're saying is, that's the part that they have to develop or become. That's why we use the term, or it become an English idiom. It's your second nature, right?
Doth not nature itself teach you?
Yeah. Right. Well, and so nature itself, now that is the first quality. It's not the characteristics. Nature itself is what's is in concrete, in stone. It says nature does this. For instance, the sun is the sun and it does what it does. The moon is the moon, et cetera, et cetera. And the male is the male and the female male and the dog and the cat, et cetera. That's the kind of nature that we were talking about there. But what we just said, your second nature, what you're saying is you've got characteristics you are developing or you're practicing. Okay? Oh, well, that wouldn't be the first one, if you're referring to that. Well, that would be a characteristic. You're right, the 1 Corinthians 11 argument. I see. Yeah, that would be the cultural practices of the day, and so therefore it would be nature. It wouldn't be nature from the first point. You're right, yeah. Yeah. And by the way, that's a good point. A lot of people think, well, by nature a man should have, in other words, because he's designed to be a man, he's not supposed to have long hair, and that's not Paul's argument at all. Paul's just saying characteristic or practice of the time. Don't you know, based upon the common practice today, that you shouldn't do this, a woman shouldn't shave her head bald, and man shouldn't... We presume a whole lot in that text when we use the improper nature. Good point. All right. Any other questions about that or comments? What is the lesson to learn from verse 21 through 24, which we look like we won't get to? Think about that one. Think about what 21 through 24 is teaching us. I find then that the principle that evil is present in me, the one who wants to do good, for I joyfully concur with the law of God in the inner man. But I see a different law in the members of my body, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin, which is in my members.
Calls yourself a wretched man.
Correct. So the Romans chapter 1 principles, what I was thinking about in nature, is the first one, of which is the design. God has said you know better because you're created this way and you know that is you're doing the opposite. Whereas the 1 Corinthians 11 illustration works well with what we just seen here. Paul is saying you are by characteristic, by practice, it is your nature that you do these things. Thank you.